Join us now for the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker is Dr. Ken Casillas of the BJU Seminary faculty. The title of his message is How to Deal with Dangerous Things. The text is from Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 1 through 6.
Our text this morning is Deuteronomy chapter 7. Let me invite you to turn there, Deuteronomy chapter 7. A few weeks ago, I was driving into school, and as I sometimes do, I turn on the radio to catch some of the latest news, and they were covering the local news at this point. And right away, my heart sank when I heard the story of a young man who was down in his home's basement with his dad. And they were actually doing a lesson on how to retain your handgun if somebody tried to take it away. Something went wrong, and the gun went off in one of those exercises. Bullet went right for the dad's head, and he was gone. Now, my heart sank because that was a very tragic incident, but also because my boys and I had been talking about guns, and they are very interested in weapons. And we had just been talking about guns and hunting and talking about maybe getting into some of that. And I thought to myself, I'm not so sure. This is pretty dangerous stuff. Now, this is not a message against guns. In fact, here over Thanksgiving, one of our friends is supposed to be taking us hunting for the first time. So we're looking forward to that opportunity. But this is a message about how you deal with dangerous things. Some things are extremely dangerous, and therefore you take special care with them. Some things are so dangerous, you just avoid them altogether. I mean, it's one thing to have a gun. You may have a reason for having one, a valid, justifiable reason. But why would you have a stash of, say, grenades in your house? You remember what Jesus said there in Matthew chapter 5 about how you live the Christian life? He said this, if thy right eye offend thee, if thy right eye becomes to you a source of spiritual problems and becomes the means by which you stumble, he says, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. If thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it off from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. That sounds pretty radical, doesn't it? It sounds pretty shocking. It sounds cruel. It sounds unreasonable. I think what we're going to see here at the beginning of Deuteronomy chapter 7 is going to be even more shocking than that. Please follow along as I read from Deuteronomy chapter 7, the first six verses. When the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and has cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou. And when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. For they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy thee suddenly. But thus shall ye deal with them. Ye shall destroy their altars, break down their images, cut down their groves, and burn their graven images with fire. For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth. What we have here is the Lord's command to the people of Israel as they're going in finally to the land of Canaan, that they ought to have a no survivor mentality as far as the Canaanites living there is concerned. It was all out holy war. And we don't want to misunderstand this. We don't want to accuse God of unfairness. If you study the background, the history of these Canaanite peoples, it was time they were ripe for judgment. And what the Lord did on this occasion is no different than what he did back in the book of Genesis with a flood that wiped out almost the entire human race that had just utterly disqualified itself from breathing God's air and living on God's earth. It is no different from what God did to the people of Sodom when he rained down fire on them for their extreme immorality. And it is nothing different than what he's going to do to all sinners who go into eternity apart outside of Christ and bring upon themselves the judgment that is due to their sins. And so there is that part to it. There is a very sobering reminder about the consequences of sin for all people. And these people had been given opportunity after opportunity to experience the mercy of God. But again and again, they turned their own way and lived their licentious lifestyle and worshiped their pagan gods. And the day of grace was over for them. There was that element, but there is another element that really is more important to the Lord in this chapter. And it is what we see there in verse 4, that he was concerned to protect the purity, to protect the integrity, to protect the loyalty of his own people. It says, deal with them severely, because if you don't, here's what's going to happen. They are going to turn away your son and your daughter from following me. They're going to engage in intermarriage with these people. That's going to open the door to my people following the way of the Gentiles. And in addition to judgment on them, this is a protection for you. It was a preventative measure. If you read on in the chapter a couple of times in verse 16 and verse 25, it describes the potential for danger with the word snare. They may be a snare to you. They may ensnare you. And that's a term that refers to literally a snare or a trap that you would use to deceive a bird, to catch him unbeknownst to him because you want him for yourself. This was the danger that these people are being protected from in this commandment. Now, there are obvious disconnects at this point between the old covenant and the new covenant. And we are not suggesting at all that we are to apply this passage in a literalistic way. I think what we ought to do is what we do with any passage from the Old Testament scriptures. And that is to apply it principally, to ask the question, why did God tell them to do this? What was his concern? What were the values that were behind that commandment? And how does that relate to my situation today, my struggles, my Christian life under the new covenant? And I think principally what we find here is that believers must deal decisively. Believers must deal decisively with spiritual dangers. And as we go on in the passage, what we find is the Lord is arguing for why they ought to do this, why they ought to be so concerned about their purity, so afraid, in a good sense, of temptation, that they just eliminate the source and possibility of temptation completely from their immediate surroundings. We have here three considerations that motivate that kind of decisive action against sources of spiritual danger. And the first of those, in verses 6 to 11, is that our status, our privileged position as the people of God is what motivates us to take those steps. I read verse 6, and it does begin with the word for, because it's giving us a reason. It's trying to motivate us to take this difficult action. And the reason is reference to our status. First of all, we are a holy people. See it there in verse 6, for thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. Now, what does the word holy mean? At this point, he's not saying you are a pure people. He's certainly not saying you are a sinless people. He is saying, I have set you apart. That's what the term holiness means. It means something that is separated from the normal course, the normal usage of things, and put in a special God-oriented status and position. It's used, for example, of the Sabbath day back in the Ten Commandments. And God says this is a holy day, or you ought to sanctify. It doesn't mean you're not supposed to sin on that day. You're not really supposed to sin on any day of the week. What it means is the activities of this day are out of the norm. They're not what characterize your average day. This one is in a special way devoted to the worship and the service of God. That is what the word holiness means here, describing the people of God. They're in a special category. God had separated them out of the mass of humanity. He had put them in an unusual, a unique position. And of all the privileges that that entailed for them was the privilege of a close relationship with God. What's the point? The point is that as the Israelites look out on those pagan peoples living whatever way they wanted, following their immoral, idolatrous rituals, given over to all kinds of unethical practices, God is saying, look, anybody can live that way. It takes zero effort to just go with the flow. Anybody can give themselves over to the lust of the flesh. Anybody can do what is natural. You are not just anybody. Recognize something of the glory of your position. Recognize something of the magnitude of the grace that I have bestowed to treat you in the special way that I have treated you. And if you ask, well, how did they end up in that special category? And why did God put them there? That leads us on a little bit further in the passage, because he goes on to tell them that not only are they holy, he says they are chosen. Listen to the end of verse 6. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people on the face of the earth. A special people. The Lord had individually selected Abraham and his descendants to fill this unique role, and he describes them as special. Sometimes that word is translated peculiar. What is that referring to? Some of us are more peculiar than others. Doesn't mean these people were odd or special in some kind of a sentimental sense. This is a term that is used to refer to the special treasures in a king's treasury, the things that he held dear, the things that gave him his net worth and that he prized materially above anything else. It's actually translated jewels on one occasion. God views you with that kind of interest. God views you with that kind of affection as his special treasure. He views you, giving you that sort of value. Maybe it's a little bit lofty to be thinking about a king's treasury. But probably all of us have things that we view as special, things that we treasure, things that we like to hold on to and keep in a special place. And we just enjoy holding it and looking at it because it means so much. It is something dear to us. So I think of that. I think of my kids who are my treasures, but also the fact that each of them has treasures. Our 6-year-old son has a growing accumulation of junk sitting on the edge of his bed that he considers treasures. And whether it's little skateboards or marbles or scraps of paper. Right now he's into collecting mechanical pencils for some reason. He doesn't want to let go of them. To us, they're trash. It's just making a mess. These are his special treasures. Do you ever think God views you that way? This is what this passage is saying. And because, in fact, God views us as special, we view our relationship with him as something of great value, meaning that we're not going to allow anything in our lives that would threaten that, that would undermine that would become an obstacle in that privileged relationship. And the Lord has chosen us out for this privilege. It says in verse 7, the Lord did not set his love upon you. And that's actually not the typical word for love in the Old Testament. It's a word that has to do with strong attachment to something. It's actually used in a different form to describe bands of silver that were wrapped around the poles in the tabernacle, wound up tight around it as a part of this construction. That's the idea. There is this strong attachment. As far as a relationship is concerned, it's used in Genesis 34:8 to speak of the attraction that Shechem felt for Dinah. This is how God feels toward us as His people. He doesn't view us as trash. He doesn't view us as whatever out there in the world, as the average person. He has put us in a special category and He has wound up tight with us. He's attached to us. Now, why does He feel that way? And why did He choose us? This passage does not answer all the questions that might come up, but it does give us part of the answer. It does tell us one of the reasons He did not choose us. Look at verse 7 at the end. God didn't choose you because you were more in number than any people, because you were the fewest of the people. It wasn't that God looked down from heaven and was just blown away, impressed so greatly by this massive group of people, the Israelites, and He says, wow, I want them on my side. They must really be something. They started out with one guy who was 75 years old and married to a barren wife. They weren't a people. It was one man. And yet God chose him anyway. It wasn't because he merited the favor of God, because he did something that just impressed God. Why was it? Well, all that this passage tells us is God attached himself to us and God chose us because he loved us. Verse 8. He made a choice to set his love on us and to commit himself to us as his people. He loves us because he loves us. There is no other explanation. And then there's an element of his faithfulness, because he made some commitments, in this case, to their forefathers. A commitment that was now 600 years old and God had not forgotten about it. And he chose in love to enter into a covenant with them. And it is all this truth about God and his individual, loving and selective relationship with us that becomes the motivation. Look at it in verse 11. Know therefore that the Lord is your God. Verse 9 and verse 11, thou shalt therefore keep the commandment. See, that is the motivation. We are God's special people. Has that ever dawned on you? Do you think about taking a stand against your own flesh and refusing to do certain things that would become a problem for you spiritually, perhaps breaking off a relationship with an unsaved person, like this passage is particularly talking about? Or perhaps breaking off a relationship with a saved person because that relationship is just not going in a godly direction? Perhaps cutting off some form of entertainment or limiting severely your participation in some activity or distancing yourself from old friends? Why would you do that? It's not because when you do that, now God's going to like you more or be impressed. The whole point is, God chose you so that you would be different. He puts you in a special category because you are so filled with gratitude. And you are so overwhelmed with His love. Because you are so touched and moved by His loyalty to you. You don't want to do anything that would threaten your loyalty to Him. Now that is our first consideration. The first motivation is our status. But that is looking at it more or less from the past. What about the future now? What would be the ramifications of my choice one way or another as far as the future is concerned? Well, the second motivation here is our prospect, which is what verses 12 to 15 are about. And we won't take the time to read all those. But if you look at verse 13, for example, it tells the people that if in verse 12 they keep these things, the Lord is going to love them and he's going to bless them and he's going to multiply them. And it goes into this long list of what they can expect as far as their circumstances are concerned. If they go in there, wipe out those people, establish a pure relationship with God, a pure form of worship, maintain right standards of morality, what's going to happen is God, in keeping with his covenant, is going to bless them with, well, just about every conceivable area of life is going to be blessed. Childbearing, it says, the growth of their agricultural products, their livestock, their own personal health, their military victory. The prospect is that God blesses obedience. Now, it sounds like this is contradicting what I just said. Because, in fact, the previous verses talked about the unmerited nature of God's love, and now it's saying if you do these things, God's going to love you and God's going to bless you. What's the deal? Well, here we're dealing with one of the many Bible tensions where you have to keep two somewhat paradoxical truths together in your mind at one and the same time. And I like the way that Peter Craigie explains this in his commentary. He says, this did not mean that obedience merited divine blessing, but rather that obedience maintained the proper covenant relationship with God, and his people would experience the blessing of God only when the covenant relationship, which involved reciprocal responsibilities, was properly maintained. Common way to explain that, a little bit easier words. You didn't get into the relationship by obeying. But once you were in the relationship, obedience was demanded and obedience did have an impact on the direction that that relationship took. And if you were obeyed, there were certain consequences positively, but you reap what you sow in either direction. If you disobeyed, there were certain consequences negatively. And as we think about our own lives, I think here again, we've got to be careful. This is not teaching us some kind of a health, wealth, and prosperity gospel that God's going to give me just anything I can imagine or anything I ask for if I'll just do the right thing. There's certainly plenty of Bible principles, even under the old covenant, that come into play here. There were exceptions to this principle. God may choose not to bless you a great deal materially because he's trying to accomplish some other purpose in your life. This isn't like an ironclad, one-size-fits-all principle. But there is certainly a general teaching here that you can expect, even under this covenant, obedience is going to bring you blessing. That you can expect, on the other hand, that disobedience is going to make your life miserable. That there are devastating consequences of sin, even in the life of a believer who has been chosen by the grace of God. And that negative side is implied here, but look as well at the statement that we find back in verse 4. It says that if these people tolerate the Canaanites around them and they end up being ensnared by them, here's what's going to happen. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy you suddenly. That's the flip side. That's one of the ways we know God is not being unfair in the treatment of the Canaanites. The same thing applied to the Israelites, too. And all you have to do is read on in the Old Testament. And what happens in the book of Judges? The very people that they tolerated, God turns around and uses to deal with them for their sins. And there is this depressing cycle of judgment again and again and again through the Canaanite peoples on the people of God. And that's not just the book of Judges. Eventually, they are totally exiled from their lands, the very same kinds of pagans from other parts of the world that they're interacting with, that they're entering into relationships with, after whom their heart is going. God uses them to deal with them about their sin. He used their sin to judge their sin. And this is one of the great dangers that often we don't realize when we fail to deal decisively with sources of temptation, just how destructive that could really be. One of my kids came home the other day from the library with a book called How to Lose a Battle. And it's a little history book that tells story after story of military encounters throughout history that ended up to be incredible blunders, tactical errors made on various occasions. And whether it was the Hessians at the Battle of Trenton, remember Washington making his way across the Delaware and the Hessians over there celebrating Christmas and really disregarding warnings of an attack, a surprise attack, and the Americans take the day. So whether it was them or the Mexicans at the Battle of San Jacinto, overconfident in what they had attained and spreading out too far and not accounting for the fact of how intense the Americans felt about the defeat at the Alamo, or whether it was the Americans themselves apparently not paying enough attention to warnings about an upcoming invasion on Pearl Harbor. One of the themes that keeps coming up again and again in the book is the reason people lose battles is that they are overconfident and they are not sufficiently taking into consideration their enemy. They are misunderstanding, underestimating the enemy. And this is what we're dealing with here spiritually. What makes this even worse is that our enemy is not just outside of us. The reason we have to deal with those forces externally is that they appeal to what is inside of us as an internal enemy there all the time, just ready to be inflamed at any moment when provoked. Let me share with you a statement from the great Puritan John Owen. He said this: there are traitors in our hearts, ready to take apart and side with every temptation and to give up all to them, to solicit and bribe temptations to do the work as traitors incite an enemy. Don't flatter yourself that you should hold out. There are secret lusts that lie lurking in your hearts, which perhaps now stir not, but which as soon as any temptation befalls you will rise and cry and seduce and never give over until they are killed or satisfied. He that promises himself that the frame of his heart will be the same under temptation as it is before will be woefully mistaken. Awake. Your enemy is not only upon you. Your enemy is in you. And because you don't trust yourself, because you are convinced that you are not strong enough, because you are aware that you really are capable of doing any sin out there, you are very careful about what you tolerate in your life that could be a source of igniting that flame within. Now, somebody says, my problem is that I am so aware of my weakness. And in fact, that's why I don't fight, because I just feel like it's an impossible battle. I have been overwhelmed so many times, there's no hope, and that actually is how the passage ends. And we have seen that we ought to be motivated to stand against spiritual dangers because of our status, because of our prospect, and the passage is going to end by talking about our resource in this battle as another motivation. And this really is about half the chapter where the Lord goes on and on to assure these people that if they will just take the step, if they will just act, they're going to find that actually there is power there. They will be enabled by the Lord to, against all odds, conquer these Canaanite people. And one of the things he does in verses 17 to 19 is to remind them of the past and trying to help them to keep alive in their memory what the Lord did to Pharaoh, what he did in the Exodus, to prove to them, to demonstrate to them, I am capable if you will just step in the right direction. And then he goes on to encourage their faith with assurances of divine aid in the future. And just to choose one statement here, if you go with me to verse 21. This really puts it in perspective. Thou shalt not be affrighted at them, for the Lord thy God is among you, a mighty God and terrible. Now, what's interesting about that is that you have two different words for fear that show up in this verse. One describes the enemy. Don't be affrighted at them. But one actually describes God. It's in the word terrible, meaning he is a God worthy to be feared. He is a fearful God in that sense. When you reckon with his greatness, when you reckon with what he's done in the past, when you reckon with all that he has available at his disposal to help you, you stand in awe of him. It comes down to a question of whom are you going to fear? Are you going to be afraid of the enemy? Or are you going to hold God in a position of exaltation and supremacy in your mind to where you stand in awe of him? Will you fear man or will you fear God? That's what it comes down to. And read this passage, and there are all these assurances of God's ability to come through for them. And all of that leads him to the final exhortation, repeating some of the things that from the beginning of the chapter, go in there, deal with these people, burn their images, don't tolerate them, no survivors, utterly detest everything that's going on among the Canaanites. Who is going to be bigger in your mind? Are you really convinced that he that is in us is greater than he that is in the world? What is it that today you need to just cut off of your life? To deal decisively with, so that it won't jeopardize the purity of this unique relationship for which God has chosen you. This passage has urged us all. It is our dealing decisively with those things, our taking the step that actually releases the power of God to enable us to overcome. May the Lord help us to be so moved by our status, the privilege of being God's people, to be so encouraged by the prospect of his blessing and the joy of obedience, and be so encouraged by his power that we will do whatever he calls on us to do.
You've been listening to the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker was Dr. Ken Casillas of the BJU Seminary faculty. For a cassette or compact disc copy of today's message, send a check for $6 to Campus Store, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, 29614. Be sure to mention the name of the speaker and today's date. The Chapel Hour has been sponsored by Bob Jones University.